NHPOil.com. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After several decades of concern about American kids expanding waistlines, there was some rare good news recently about the very youngest kids. According to a federal Centers for Disease Control report, obesity rates among American children aged 2 to 5 dropped from 14% a decade ago to 8.5% today. Now, in the weeks since these numbers were released, researchers have been slicing and dicing them, with some saying they're skeptical the improvement is as dramatic as that. But whether they're cheering a lot or a little, there's some indication of a positive trend among the preschool set. Now the question is how to extend these gains to the rest of America's kids. And there, the statistics are discouraging. The CDC finds that nearly 18% of children ages 6 to 11 are obese, as are 20% of U.S. teens. Today in The Exchange, a checkup for childhood obesity. Let's hear from you. What do you think might be behind this little bit of good news? And why do you think there's been no improvement for older kids? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests with us. Joining us from Hanover is Patricia Anderson, professor of economics at Dartmouth College, who's been studying childhood obesity for about 10 years. And Professor Anderson, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
And with me in studio, Terry Johnson, director of HEAL New Hampshire, an organization that works to foster healthy living statewide through partnerships with state agencies, philanthropic organizations, community groups. Terry Johnson, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's great to be here.
And also with us, Travis Harker, a family doctor at the Concord Family Health Center. His training focused on improving the screening, diagnosis, and treatment of obesity. And Dr. Harker, good to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, first, if we could just look at this CDC report showing a drop among the littlest kids. Dr. Harker, you first. Were you surprised by these numbers?
I was a little surprised by this because I haven't felt a big change in my practice as I continue to treat children. I have made a practice of talking to children about being healthy, making healthy choices, eating their 5 fruits and vegetables a day, 2 hours or fewer of screen time, an hour of activity, and zero sugary drinks. I make the 5-2-1-0 campaign kind of a part of what I do with my patients. And so it's nice to see it on a population level that things are starting to change. I'm an optimist, and so I know that some people are cautious about the numbers, but I think it's a good sign. And if I think back to 2002 when I first came to New Hampshire, we didn't have a system of screening or diagnosing children with weight problems. We weren't using the BMI percentiles, which is a way of assessing a child's health status based on their height, their weight, their age, and their gender. And so we're doing a lot of that now. And I think that's been a bit of a help.
Well, and since you use BMI, body mass index, could we just get a quick definition from you, Dr. Harker, on what obesity is? You know, is it 10 pounds over the norm? Is it 30? What is it?
So it kind of depends. So for adults, I'll start with that, and then we'll go to kids, because adults, it's simpler. It's if your body mass index, which is an equation that uses your height and your weight, is over 25, then you're considered overweight. And if it's over 30, you're in the obese category. But for children, it's more complicated because children, as many of you know, follow a growth curve, and their BMI follows a growth curve as well. And so we look at BMI percentiles. So if you're over the 85th percentile on your child age 2 to 18, then you're in the overweight category. And if you're over the 95th percentile, you get a diagnosis of obesity.
When you first started out, Dr. Harker, what was the comfort level of physicians, family physicians like yourself, when a child was seriously overweight or obese? How did you approach that conversation back then, and do you approach it differently now, given all the attention to this issue? It's not an easy thing to say to a kid or his or her parents.
So I have a fairly large practice. There's over 20, close to 30 providers in our practice, and we surveyed them, and many of them didn't feel comfortable bringing the subject up. And so we tried to develop some scripts, some prompts on how to address the subject and framing it around health as opposed to looks or body image, because that's really what our primary goal is to make sure that these children grow up to be healthy, happy adults. And we know that if children have problems with weight, that they have a 5 times at least likelihood of developing obesity as an adult.
Yeah. So, Terry Johnson, you've been working on this issue for a long time, again, with HEAL. What do you think about these numbers, first of all? Whether it shows a big improvement or a small improvement, we'll get to that. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think I'm glad that the numbers are being vetted. I think it's one study that's out there right now. I'm sure that there will be a lot of follow-up research around this as well. But, you know, I think that there are some positive trends that are occurring. Even if you look in New Hampshire, if you look nationwide, you'll see that, you know, for example, there was some positive improvements among children in federal feeding programs and the Women's Infants and Children's Program. We just saw last year that there was a minor decrease in obesity amongst those children. In New Hampshire, you're seeing that, you know, the numbers amongst all age groups are beginning to flatten out, I think, which is a good trend as well. And there's been work that's been happening nationally similar to HEAL in states throughout the country and at the national level. There's been some great initiatives such as Michelle Obama's Let's Move. So I think, you know, I think the trend is positive. It'll be interesting to see what other research shows in terms of, you know, where those numbers really land. But I think we are beginning to see at least a leveling off.
Let's get your broad thoughts, Professor Anderson, too, on this.
So I'm not sad about it. I'm not convinced entirely yet. I mean, these data do come from the gold standard data set, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. But it's still a pretty small survey. They try to oversample 2 to 5-year-olds. It's the best we've got. It's been pretty steady at around 10-ish percent for a while. I'd like to see a couple more years of this lower one before I was declaring victory. But I think it's encouraging.
And overall, what sorts of trends are you seeing, Professor Anderson, over the past 10 years that you've been studying childhood obesity?
You know, after a lot of increases in the sort of mid to late 80s, it really has seemed to flatten out a bit in the last, say, 5 or 6 years. And that's true with adults, too, which I think is encouraging. Whether this is kind of something more natural where folks with the genetic background that were susceptible to environmental changes all kind of tipped over to obese and were left with those people that, you know, were the friend you had in high school who ate everything in sight and never gained weight, or whether we're really making good progress with policies, I'm not convinced yet.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at what might be behind this trend and what we could do to further the small success that we may be seeing. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at childhood obesity, once again on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. So looking at some of the policies that you all have touched on, to you, I think, Terry Johnson, you mentioned changes in the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program. This is a federal program that gives nutrition to women, infants, and children, low income. What sorts of changes has that program made, and how might that have helped?
Well, there's been a reformulation in what can be purchased with that program. So there's more of a focus now on fresh fruits and vegetables, for example, less focus on, you know, high nutrient dense foods, trying to decrease, you know, the high nutrient dense foods that children are eating as well.
What's a high nutrient dense food?
It's foods that are, you know, laden with calories. So it's foods that are high in fat. It's foods that are, you know, maybe processed foods that are high in calories.
But because nutrient sounds good.
Yeah, nutrient does sound good, but basically they're foods that really are encouraging children and adults to eat more calories than are really recommended on a daily basis as well. But you're seeing a change in the foods that are available through that program primarily, especially along the lines of more fruits and vegetables.
And from what I've seen, and you touched on this earlier, in New Hampshire, in that population, you have seen some small improvement because of these changes.
We have, as well as across the country. So that's a federal program, so the changes are occurring across the country, but it is encouraging that we're seeing this in New Hampshire as well.
What other policies, Dr. Harker, have you seen, whether it's schools, whether it's nutrition programs, whether it's within families, that give you some encouragement?
One thing that really was I think, important in the transition from New Hampshire, where we were with our weight issues, into where we are now, is that we didn't have a goal before. There was a statewide organizing campaign around that was started through the U.S. the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services to pull stakeholders together, medical providers, school professionals, business professionals, community organizations and municipalities, and they worked to help found HEAL around healthy eating and active living. And so having a target, something to shoot for, I think has been really important. And I think a lot of times with weight, people look at it as a simple problem where you have, if we just eat better and move more, or if we eat less and move more, we'll solve the problem. But we know it's a much more complex system that we're dealing with. It involves genetics, the environment, a fast food culture, increased time on, with our screens, with our TVs, our games, our phones, family dynamics are changing. We'd had a decrease in the amount of women that were breastfeeding. And as a result, I think in part to increased attention through in the media on your show and other outlets, having a focus in our communities on weight as an issue and the impacts on health, we've started to make some changes. And as any complex problem, it deserves a complex set of solutions as well. And we won't probably be able to point to any one policy and say, this is the policy that helped us cure the obesity epidemic. But we can say by having a whole suite of things that involve the schools, employers, having moms breastfeed more. I mean, in the past probably 10 years, we've had seen a 10% increase in the number of moms breastfeeding all the way up through 6 months and beyond. So that's, I think that, and there's a lot of evidence on that, and there's evidence that, that these things are all working together, maybe not in predictable ways, but in a way that's is having some impact.
And I know, Professor Anderson, you worked on the breastfeeding issue and its link to this and raised some questions about it. So I want to ask you about that in just a minute. But Dr. Harker, to your point, you know, it's complicated, screens, family dynamics, genetics, schools, et cetera. But at some level, isn't it about what you said initially, you know, calories in, calories out?
So at its most basic level, it is that. But we can't simply rely on an individual to do that if the environment and the culture doesn't support that.
Okay. We will talk more, a lot more, in just a moment. Get your thoughts to questions and comments about childhood obesity here on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Day one of NHPR's March Fund Drive is this Wednesday, and we're planning to raise the entire day's goal in just 4 hours. Your donation now counts towards the tally and helps us collect $10,000 in challenge money. Pay for the new service you rely on with a pledge of support at nhpr.org. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny for most of the state today, mostly cloudy from the mountains, north highs in the 40s. Snow on the way tomorrow into Wednesday. It will be heavy at times. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More business.comcast.com. And from New Hampshire State Council on the Arts, presenting Poetry Out Loud High School State Finals, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the State House. Public is welcome. Details at nh.gov/nharts. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a checkup for childhood obesity. We're looking at some new numbers that indicate some rare good news about obesity rates among the very youngest kids, but also that obesity rates for older kids and teens have not budged. We're looking at that, and we want to hear from you. What do you think might be behind this small improvement, and why do you think there's been no improvement for older kids? What are some of the factors that you see contributing to childhood obesity here in New Hampshire? 1-800-892-6477 is our number, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Anderson, could we talk a little bit about the role breastfeeding might play in this small decline in obesity rates that we've seen among the preschool set? That's something that a lot of folks are pointing to.
Well, there's a lot of the studies on breastfeeding are really observational. The few studies that have tried to get more at causality have not been that encouraging. So whenever you look at siblings within the same family, one who's breastfed and one who's not, there's no difference. There was a study in Eastern Europe somewhere, I can't remember if it was Bulgaria or another country, where mothers, new mothers in the hospital were randomly assigned to get additional breastfeeding counseling. And the ones who got that counseling were much more likely to breastfeed, but their kids weren't any slimmer in the follow-up. So I think it's true that observationally, it seems like kids that are breastfed end up leaner, but I think it's more the parents that are into breastfeeding are also more careful about nutrition when they're older. So I'm not sure that, you know, we could snap our fingers and if everyone breastfed, it would go away without the associated new interest in nutrition among the mothers.
Interesting. So it's more societal and less about the actual breastfeeding.
That's the way I feel like the research is telling us.
Or family attitudes. And yet that doesn't take away, right, Professor Anderson, the benefits of breast milk itself, never mind the family, to boost the child's immune system and so forth.
Oh, there's plenty of reasons you might want to breastfeed. But I don't think you should say, oh, if I just do this, my child will be slim.
You know, when we look at this issue, a lot of folks look at the schools and some of the changes that have happened there as contributing and now possibly helping with this problem. Here's an email from Russ who says, doesn't the weight gain have a lot to do with the elimination of daily physical education at all school levels? Russ, it's a great question. And Terry Johnson, that's for you first. I hate to say I remember when I was a kid. But boy, we had gym, you know, three times a week. Now they have it once a week, maybe.
Yeah, they do. And there's no standard requirement to offer physical education on a regular basis.
Now, when did that change and why? Who thought that was a good idea?
Well, I'm not sure exactly when it changed, but I know that it's not a requirement right now. So but physical activity is, you know, I go back to what Travis said. There are many factors that are contributing to children's as well as adults' physical activity and eating levels. And so physical activity is just one of those. But in schools, if you consider that children are spending, you know, the bulk of their waking hours in schools, there's an excellent opportunity within the school environment to provide physical activity, even if it's not through physical education. Nutrition, you know, providing healthy meals as well. And you'll see some really creative things that are happening in schools now in terms of incorporating energy breaks into even during study periods. There are schools in Merrimack, Thornton's Ferry, and Reed's Ferry School that have won Education and Excellence Awards in the state. And they're actually listening to the students and looking at their attention during educational lessons and giving them the latitude to, you know, raise their hand and say it's time for an energy break. And you're seeing some great work happening around the state to incorporate, you know, more recess and physical activity into the school curriculum itself. So it is a very important factor.
Is your organization, Terry, Heal New Hampshire, talking to the state school board and saying, look, this is a really serious problem. We're setting our kids up to have a difficult life if we let them continue to be obese. Mm-hmm. You, State School Board of New Hampshire, need to insist that schools have, you know, gym three times a week. I mean, are you going that far? Can you do that in a state like New Hampshire where everything's locally controlled?
It's tough. It is tough. But there has been some success more on the nutrition side. Just back in 2009 when the New Hampshire Childhood Obesity Commission was formed and put forward 14 recommendations around childhood obesity. And one of those was to adopt through the School Board of Education rules that all schools are required to adopt a nutrition standard for all food served outside the school meals program. And that happened. In 2011, those rules were adopted. School districts throughout the state are now required to select a nutrition standard for food served outside of the school meals program and implement that. And that's happening currently.
Outside the school meals program meaning vending machines?
So, yeah, school celebrations, vending machines, a la carte in lunchrooms, you know, anywhere that foods are served in the school environment outside of the school meals program. So I think that's a precursor to conversations that can happen around physical activity as well.
There's been a lot of conversation, Dr. Harker, I know you know this, about making school lunches healthier and the snacks that Terry mentions. But there's also been some coverage that, you know, sometimes the kids just won't eat it. I think one of the newspapers, maybe it was a Union Leader, had an article about all the food that gets thrown away because they're just not eating it. I know this from my own personal experience. You're talking to my kids and their friends. They say, you know, they started making the lunches healthier and they don't taste as good. So, you know, you can build it, but will they come?
So what I tell parents is that it's our job to provide nutritious options for our children, and it's our children's job to choose from those options what they're going to eat. And so we can't force our children to eat those five fruits and vegetables a day, but we could work with them and make sure that our house is full of those types of options as opposed to options that maybe aren't as healthy for you, such as chips or soda or ice cream and cookies. And so not to say that all of those things are bad or we shouldn't have those from time to time, but in balance and to try to focus on making sure that we serve up the type of things that are important. One thing that I found is involving the children in the cooking or the growing of the food can be really helpful. Even if you have like a window box tomato plant, the kids get really excited about that. And they for whatever reason, they think those tomatoes taste better than any other tomatoes they've ever had. And so if you involve the children in it, they're much more likely to try it. And I think we should, as parents, feel confident that if we expose our children to healthy options as children, that even if they don't eat everything that we want them to eat now, that as an adult, they are much more likely to experiment and to try fruits and vegetables. I'll speak for myself. As a child, I didn't eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, and my brother ate even fewer. But as adults, we both have our five servings a day of fruits and vegetables, and I think it's because of the foundation that my parents set forward.
Our phone number again for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Russ, thanks for that email. Join us as we look at some of the new numbers concerning childhood obesity, how those rates have not budged for older kids and teens, but maybe moving a little bit for the youngest kids. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Professor Anderson, I wanted your thoughts, too, on school policy. Terry talked about recess, physical activity. Both our guests here in studio have talked about nutrition policies. What have you found when you've looked at this?
So I've looked at a few things. One is just asking whether school is better than not schools, because there's a lot of studies showing some bad things about school. There's studies that show school lunch causes weight gain. I've done studies on exposure to junk food in school is bad. There's a lot of the studies that, you know, there's not that much exercise going on. And so what we did was look at basically close to seven-year-olds, one of whom had just finished kindergarten because they just missed the cutoff to start when they were turning five, and another who was finishing first grade because they just made the cutoff. And so they'd been exposed to either 1 or 2 years of school. And it turned out that there really wasn't that much difference. And if anything, the child who'd been in school for 2 years was a little bit leaner. And it seems like what you can almost think of is that school keeps you from snacking that you might have done at home, even though there are snacks available. There's not as many as your caregiver might have given you. But it is true that, you know, in school activity can be important. I've done some simulations where if you just add an hour of physical activity per week over the course of the school year, you'd expect a 1 to 2 percentage point lower obesity rate.
Wow, just 1 hour per week, not even per day.
I mean, every week for the entire, you know, school year. So
that's pretty dramatic, though, Professor Anderson. What do you think are the forces behind schools not doing that?
Well, there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, testing these days. And so a lot of schools in trying to make their, you know, yearly progress under No Child Left Behind or things like that will decide, you know, rather than having recess or PE, we should do another math worksheet or we should do a vocabulary drill. And so I actually have some research looking at whether No Child Left Behind might inadvertently be contributing to obesity. And we have fairly weak evidence, but some evidence that schools that are kind of right on the edge of making their annual yearly adequate yearly progress actually do have slightly more overweight kids than schools that are easily making it or just not even coming close.
Well, I wonder what the studies also say about the children's ability to soak up that extra math worksheet, as you put it, Professor Anderson, when they've had recess versus whether they haven't. I mean, they need to blow off steam, right?
Yeah, no, a lot of the education research is that, you know, that extra time spent in activity actually makes you more ready to learn when you come back. So they're sort of, you know, cutting off their nose despite their face, I think, by cutting recess.
Let's take some comments and questions from our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And John's waiting in Manchester. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. Great conversation. I mean, great topic. It's such a thing on the forefront about kids and obesity and the future of this country, because these guys are going to be the leaders and the outlook. And I see that it is slightly improving, but you know, I mean, the outlook is that, well, these guys are leaders, they're going to be sick. That being said, one of the, I think the biggest, I'm a practitioner and I deal with all levels of healthcare from an alternative holistic standpoint. And one of the things that kind of sticks out and it isn't really addressed is that parents really need to read labels. I heard the gentleman comment earlier that, you know, give them a cookie or a cracker once in a while. And they're loaded with fructose. Everything has so much high corn syrup and fructose embedded in it under different, even under different names that sort of, you know, chemically will backtrack to it. And people and parents really need to review labels. And if they don't understand something, go and ask, Google it or whatever before they give it to them. And keep the sugar out of their diet. Just keep it out.
John, it's a great point, and a lot of attention has focused on this recently, Dr. Harker.
So I think, John, you make a great point about the amount of sugar that our children eat. And even parents who think they're doing a good job and limiting sugar, if they're not reading the labels, they might be missing things out. The best example in my practice is parents come in and saying, oh, I don't give my child soda, I give them juice. And it takes a lot of working with them for them to understand that juice has nearly as much sugar as a soda. And they really struggle with that because they've been brought up to think that juice is healthy, juice is nutritious, and it's the
like having a piece of fruit, only just the watery part.
Exactly. And so undoing that is takes a lot of work, because the conventional wisdom is strong that the fruit is good for you, and by extension, fruit juice would be. And so I spent a lot of my time talking to patients about that.
Yeah, so in the drinks, and I have also heard that this small decline in little kids' obesity rates, Terry Johnson, may partly be due to some of the changes that you and Professor Anderson talked about, but also the sugary drinks. There has been a lot more focus on that, and kids do seem to be consuming less.
There is some evidence that that is occurring, and that is very important when you consider. You know, when I grew up, you know, I won't say when, but, you know, I think the average size of a soda at that point was, you know, something like 8 ounces or 6 ounces. And now, you know, we know the size of sodas that can be purchased. We know, you know, Mayor Bloomberg did make a pretty strong effort to try to restrict some of that in New York City. But it is very important to realize just how big of a role sugar-sweetened beverages are playing in this obesity epidemic. And you know, within physicians' offices and schools, there's a great message that's been used for years now to try to really help parents and children understand, you know, what are some of the most important factors to adopt within their lifestyles. And it's a 5-2-1-0 message, and it's focused on 5 fruits and vegetables per day, 2 hours.
Not juice. Fruits.
Fruits. Yeah, fruits, exactly. And also two hours or less of screen time per day for children, and they're averaging 6 hours per day now. 1 hour of exercise per day, and 0 sugar-sweetened beverages. So can't say how strong that messaging is. And also to John's point, I just want to say really quickly that there are some great things that are happening now around labeling in grocery stores. There are some federal requirements that are coming down. Nutrition labels are very challenging to read currently. So there's efforts that are being made to simplify that so people can more easily get at, you know, what really they are eating. And the same thing is occurring with restaurants as well, too. We're looking at seeing calorie counts and calorie information being posted in restaurants as well.
Well, John, thanks for the call. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Haley is calling in from Newmarket. Hi, Haley. You're on the air. Okay, Haley, I hope you call back. Again, the number for you and everyone else is 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Susie in Canaan, and I'll throw this to you, Professor Anderson. Susie says, increased phys ed classes are all well and good as long as they are done well. As a non-coordinated student, the main thing I learned from PE was that physical activity was an opportunity for embarrassment. It made me less likely to exercise, not more. Susie, thank you very much for that very honest email. She's right, Professor Anderson. You know, gym class is great for some and a nightmare for others.
I think there has been a movement among particularly elementary school phys ed teachers in trying to sort of work on fitness for life, where it's not the old classic, let's kill each other with a dodgeball or, you know, force you to play softball or basketball, but sort of try to learn movement skills that you can carry on through life. Now, is this happening in all schools? No, but I think that is something that people recognize, that there's a set of people that sort of dread physical activity because of the introduction they had in grade school. So I think it's a good movement that's happening. Has it spread enough? Probably not. But what I think we're overlooking is the possibility for just recess. I mean, kids left to their own devices will run around in circles. I mean, maybe they don't anymore, but they certainly did when I was young. They just
Although,
let us
Professor
out the door.
Anderson, we did a show about 2-3 months ago on some elementary schools banning games like tag because they don't want the kids to get hurt.
You know, there's things I can say about litigious societies and overprotective parents, but that's not the topic of today's show. So let's just say that maybe we're a little too overprotective. You don't even have to have an organized tag game. Just let them out the door, and I think a lot of them are going to move. and that's what you want.
One of the things I was going to mention is I see that people aren't engaging in extracurricular physical activity, whether it's just free time, going to the park and playing, or joining up to local sports leagues that are not really competitive. I live in Manchester, and my daughter's been part of the Manchester North Soccer League for the past number of years. And there's children of all abilities out on the field, the children who maybe aren't as coordinated, and then there's some children that play on traveling teams there. And so they see the whole breadth of the sport, but they're able to all enjoy it and have a good time. And I think that more activities like that do more than just help our children be healthy, but they help our whole community grow. Because I go down to the soccer games, I see other adults there, I meet other parents, and maybe I go exercise with them. There's a Turkey Day fun run in my neighborhood that we go to, and I would say half the families that I know there come from like Manchester soccer. So it's about building a kind of a critical mass of physical activity within our community. So it's something that we just do.
All right. Well, Susie, thank you very much for the email. We welcome your emails at exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More conversation about childhood obesity in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
Why become an NHPR member? Well, how about well-researched news and information?
Was put up. Voters in Goshen will decide on Saturday whether it should pull out of the school district it shares with another wind farm host, Leominster.
How about fascinating conversations?
Strong vote. Put this in the big picture, Dean, of where the 50 states are lining up in terms of expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
Right, and we've been talking about this issue for the better part.
Made possible by members. Become one now at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from People's United Bank, serving individuals and businesses throughout the Northeast for over 170 years in branches and online, peoples.com. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health, 13 locations statewide, information at d-hdocs.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the reported decrease in childhood obesity among very young children, what might be behind it, and why we're not seeing the same trends beyond the preschool set. We invite you to join us with your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Twitter @NHPR Exchange or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Anderson, you know, we've touched on schools and societal issues, food labeling and healthcare providers. We've talked somewhat about family life, but I know that's an area of research that you've been focusing on, and I did want to ask you a little bit more about that. What shifts have we seen on the part of parents, maybe of younger kids, that could be leading to these lower obesity rates, or among parents of older kids that are causing these rates not to budge? What are you seeing?
So, broadly speaking, I've done some research on sort of the lack of time among parents, mainly through higher labor supply of mothers. And what it seems to be the case is that with these new time constraints, you're just much less likely to be able to, you know, make a home-cooked meal, bring your kid to the parks like we were talking about. And so you've got your organized sports because they sort of work as a daycare sort of substitute. And it's possible, I wouldn't swear to this, with the younger kids, there has been a bit of a opting out movement you read about in, you know, the New York Times and stuff, where educated mothers are spending more time in the home with their young children. So it's possible that has an impact, and then go back when their kids are older. I should make clear that I'm not claiming that mothers shouldn't be working. What I'm saying is that given the reality of dual career households, there need to be better, faster, healthy choices available, right? So that you can, and you're seeing this in the grocery stores where they'll have the rotisserie chicken and things like, you know, prepared meals that you can sort of pick up. You don't have to drive through McDonald's when you have a half hour between school and soccer practice to pick up your kid.
Now, I got one of those chickens last night. Did you see me at the store picking that up? Because you're right. It's a quick, easy, and relatively healthy choice. So are you saying, Professor Anderson, that moms who work a lot have kids who are more obese? Because that's pretty sobering, given the number of moms who work.
I mean, It's a small effect, but this is what we found, and it's the intensity of work. It's not just being at work. It's sort of, you know, if you change from part-time to full-time over the life of your child, they would be about a percentage point more likely to be overweight.
So contributing, not huge, but contributing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you want to jump in, Dr. Harker, and also you, Terry Johnson? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yes, I think it's in addition to having an overwhelming kind of lifestyle that we're living now where we're working a lot, there is a lot of found time that we should be able to reclaim. For instance, I talk to patients all the time about, do you ever find yourself sitting in front of the TV watching something and saying, gosh, there's nothing on, but you don't get up and you don't turn it off? And I think there are many opportunities to kind of take stock of what's important to you and what's not, and then make decisions based on that. And I'll say that healthy living is not something that we do to our children or for our children. It's something we need to do with our children. Because if we're expecting them to be healthy or to go active, be active, or to eat right, we need to be doing that as well as their parents. And if we're not, then there's a disconnect. And as a family doctor, I'm able to work with parents who are oftentimes my patients as well, and on a family solution around how they approach eating and how they approach activity and what their priorities are around that.
Yeah, I'd love your thoughts too, Terry Johnson, on family structure, family life, and how it contributes.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think one other really important factor, though, too, is when you have, you know, more and more two-parent working families, you know, what are the other environments that children are spending their time in that can have an impact on their physical activity and nutrition behaviors? And, you know, in New Hampshire, we have about 47,500 children that are in child care facilities. And there has been a great movement throughout the state led by the Department of Health and Human Services and funded by foundations like the H&H Foundation to improve nutrition standards and physical activity policies within child care settings. So, you know, just since 2009 through 2013, there have been 46 child care centers in New Hampshire that the staff have been trained to provide healthier foods and physical activity within child care environments. And you're seeing, you know, more and more HEAL community coalitions taking on work within child care settings as well. So, you know, so while the home environment is very important, I think it's important that we look at all the environments that children spend their day in.
Let's take another call. This is Dave in Henniker. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, first off, I work in an office that's next door to an elementary school in Concord, and I see when kids go outside at recess, they run, they play, they do the natural thing is to be moving a lot. But my wife, who is a teacher in a third grade in another school district, is having very limited time to take her kids outside. There's a lot of pressure on to get the scores up, and there's no health committee anymore at the school. The health committees, I know, are supposed to be looking at the health of the children. There's a lot of focus on obesity when you have those councils or those committees. But if the superintendents and the school board and the principal don't say that health is a focus, then they just say, okay, if the focus is getting better scores on the statewide test, then those things get to be dropped. I think it's a major disservice to the children.
Dave, thanks for the call. Professor Anderson, this is something you touched on earlier. Go ahead if you want to jump back in.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely with that. You know, as I said, our study seems to show we're looking at Arkansas because we had the data for that where, you know, the focus on test scores, which we defined as schools that were sort of within 5 points of making their adequate yearly progress on their test scores, had kids that were about a half point higher obesity rate than the other schools. And we surveyed principals about what was going on in their schools. And they definitely said, you know, we've cut back recess, we've cut back PE to spend more time on test prep. We've done, you know, the flip side is they also do things like promise, you know, parties and cupcakes and things if you do well on the tests. And, you know, or do well on a practice test. And so it's kind of being hit from both sides. There's even a sort of third level, which is a lot of times you skew the budget towards these test prep activities, and if you still want to do other things, you need to raise money for that. And often the way you do that is, you know, the band sells candy to get new uniforms, or you sign a contract with a vending company to get a fraction of the sales. And so it's all sort of spiraling in the wrong direction in terms of, you know, keeping the kids healthy.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you for the call, Dave. Good observations. Let's go to Mike next in Portsmouth. Thanks, Mike, for joining us. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Howdy. Thank you. What I'm touching on was brought up just a moment ago in the broader sense of family health. Since it's America, why don't we just incentivize via taxes? If everybody in the family is fit, you have lower taxes. And that's about it.
So weigh people before they pay their taxes. And who would do that weighing, Mike?
Well, it'd just be part of your annual checkup.
Yeah.
You have your once-a-year checkup, compare it to last year, look against the mean of society, and if you're below, lower your taxes. If you're above, raise them.
Mike, thanks for calling in. This is a controversial idea, I'm guessing. Both of you guys look like you want to jump in. Terry Johnson, I'll turn to you first.
Yeah, I don't want to go there, especially in New Hampshire with our style of government here in terms of you know, trying to implement a policy like that. But I will say that, Mike, you are on the right track, and there are some examples of similar policies happening in private work sites through insurance plans where there are both incentives that are being given for people to adopt healthier lifestyles on their insurance, and there are also penalties for people who are assessed as overweight or obese or not being physically active. That if they don't change their lifestyle, that they will be paying higher insurance premiums than you know, their colleagues who are pursuing healthier lifestyles as well. So I think there is, you know, there is a precedent, but I you know, I think that you know, to do so, you know, from a government policy perspective might be a little bit challenging and controversial.
So not public policy taxes, but through the private sector insurance rates, you are seeing that sort of financial penalty.
You are. And it's that's fairly new. I mean, the focus prior to this by a lot of employers was more on incentives, encouraging employees to become more physically active and eat healthier and be healthier in general would help them, you know, receive a reduction in their health insurance premium or more subsidization by the employer. But now you're seeing some employers are really concerned about the impact on employee productivity, for example, of being obese and having chronic disease. And so they're taking it seriously and actually requiring employees more to adopt healthy
and are
healthier
they
lifestyles.
Giving employees time to do that or do they want you to take the report home and work on it at home and be here on Saturday and so forth?
No, that's a great question, and many work sites are. I think you're seeing you know, for example, the Cheshire Heal Coalition, Healthy Monadnock 2020 and Cheshire Medical Center has done some great work and has been recognized by CDC for work with small work sites also at Cheshire Medical Center. And they are seeing that employers are looking at providing more flex time for their employees to be physically active, and they realize the benefits of changing the work environment that way to allow that time for their employees.
Dr. Hark, I can see you want to jump in.
I firmly believe that incentives that are externally motivated aren't nearly as powerful as ones that are intrinsically motivated. And every patient, every person that I've met wants to be healthy. Anyone who has a weight problem doesn't want to have a weight problem. And they've worked really hard to address it. I think what makes this conversation different is we're talking about children aged 2 to 5 where we're seeing this benefit. We're starting to see this trend shift. And I think the incentive on the parent side is to have a healthy child grow up to be to not have a weight problem. I think adding monetary things to it may complicate it, and it might not be effective and get into privacy and who measures. So there's logistical things with it. But I think if we really support parents in helping them have healthy children, that's what they want, and that's what I try to give them in my practice.
Well, how hard is it for you, Dr. Harker, to help parents help their kids adopt healthy lifestyles, food, exercise, outdoors, and so forth, when so many American parents themselves are not having a healthy lifestyle?
So I start a conversation about it. I talk about some of the adults, the parents, have health problems, and I can put it into context and say, if by changing things, you can help yourself and your child, and you can help your child prevent the problems that you're wrestling with right now.
Let's take another call. This is Steve in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Actually, I'm following up on this whole idea about parents being involved with physical activity. It's the idea of modeling. If the child sees the parent active, they're going to be active. One of the things I did when I would come home from work is I would basically flip my kids over. Those are days they watch television rather than computers. And they know we're going for a walk to the water. And they say, oh, no. But then we went on a hike because I want them to be physically active. I belong to the Appalachian Mountain Club. And I love to see parents and kids hiking and skiing together. The idea is that if you do it together with them, it sets a model. I've taken my 4 kids to the White Mountains, and at least one of them still goes hiking. So I know if they see you do it and you do it with them, that's a terrific message that sticks with. And it does lead to, as they said, intrinsic values. If you see it and do it with your parents, then you build it into your system of health.
Well, Steve, it's a great point, and it sounds like you got some pushback from them, but you overcame that.
Well, they said, no, we want to stay. You've taken scout troops, and they say, hey, no, we want to stay and watch television. No, you get out and you hike. And then once you do it, they love it.
Steve, thanks for the call. Patty, what do you think? Again, we're talking about so much, parents, schools, community, doctors. What are your thoughts on our caller's point?
I mean, I think it's, in an ideal world, that works great. When you've got 2 parents who are at work until 7 o'clock and it's dark and the kid's been in daycare all day and you're exhausted on the weekend, all your best intentions can sort of go out the window. But, I think ideally we'd need to have parents, schools, communities all sort of working together to demonstrate that we care about activity, we care about nutrition, and I think we just don't quite really see that, although it is turning in that direction indicating that, the Let's Move initiative, the having healthier school lunches, even if the kids maybe don't like them that much. I think we're starting to try to model those behaviors around the realities of the busy lives that people have.
Yeah, go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we don't want to lose sight of during this conversation, too, is that we're, in terms of the research numbers that we're talking about here, we're looking at them in general across the population. But I think it's really important to understand, as that latest study pointed out as well, too, and this is backed by many other studies, that we're seeing higher trends of chronic disease and obesity amongst racial and minority populations and low-income families within our state and throughout the country as well. I mean, the study did say that, in comparison to the 1 in 12 overall, 2 to 5-year-olds that are obese, with African Americans, it's 1 in 6, and with Hispanics, it's 1 in 9.
Wow.
We're seeing in deprived neighborhoods in Nashua and Manchester that obesity and chronic disease rates are higher amongst families that are in the low-income neighborhoods in certain census tracts. And so, I think to Patty's point, it's really important to understand that there are economic challenges in place for those families as well. They're working multiple jobs to get by. And so there really does need to be a lot of reliance on how can we make physical activity and healthy eating a routine part of both our children's and our adult lives.
And so that gets to the point that, you know, our caller says parents need to do this. Absolutely. But you seem to be saying, Terry, that, you know, when a parent is working three jobs, okay, let's call in some other actors, community groups, schools, churches, whatever.
All of it. Yeah. I mean, it's all important. I mean, we've been talking about this throughout the conversation that there are so many factors that have contributed to the obesity epidemic. And there are so many strategies that need to be utilized in all settings that children are in throughout the day, including the home, including the schools, childcare, and the community that they're surrounded by as well. If you don't have safe parks to go to, you know, you're less likely to use them.
Go ahead, Dr. Harker.
This part of the conversation reminds me of a patient who he was 4 years old and he was developing a weight problem. And I talked with his mom about it and about trying to be more physically active. And she said, well, I don't know my neighbors. I don't feel safe letting him outside to play. And so she's a single mom. And the only way that she could know to take care of him was to keep him inside. And I said, get to know your neighbors. The crime statistics are saying that we're living in a safer time than we've ever had, but getting to know your community, your neighbors, and get outside. I think that was my message to her.
Yeah, we've done several programs on that trend and how it's working with or against this childhood obesity. People not wanting to let their kids out because they think it's not safe and maybe not having a true picture. Is that what you're saying,
yes.
Dr. Harker? This has been a great conversation. Thank you all very much for being here. Professor Anderson, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Patricia Anderson, professor of economics at Dartmouth College, who studies childhood obesity. Travis Harker, it was good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you. Be well.
That's Dr. Travis Harker, a family doctor at the Concord Family Health Center. And Terry Johnson, thank you also.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Terry Johnson, director of HEAL New Hampshire, an organization that works to foster healthy living statewide. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. You're economical with your time, and you listen to NHPR because it lets you do other things while you catch up on the news. We're economical with your time, too, and only do as much fundraising as we need to keep the programs you love going. That's why we're planning to raise our entire day's fundraising goal for day one of our March drive in just 4 hours. When we hear from 350 people, we'll cancel the drive for the rest of the day and collect $10,000 in challenge money. Your contribution now helps at nhpr.org.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Jensen Communities with 6 locations in New Hampshire, including the new Brookridge community in Hooksett. One floor living in safe, friendly neighborhoods, jensencommunities.com. MPC Connection, a committed employer of New Hampshire's technology workforce, headquartered in Merrimack with facilities in Keene and Portsmouth, pcconnection.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Catastrophic mechanical failure, terrorism, a hijacking, pilot suicide? Nothing so far has been ruled out as a possible explanation for the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Ships, planes, and helicopters are